Here is your Radio Theater Channel weekly podcast for download. The RTC still has old-time radio on the live streaming. And if it's music you love, tune in to the RTC Music Channel. You can find links to both channels and many other things on our website at oldtimeradiolisten.com. And now, my darling nephew, Wolfgang, who is hosting while I go out for a bite.
Thanks, Uncle Vlad, for that great introduction. Hi, everyone. I'm Wolfgang, Vlad's nephew. But you can call me Wolf. I got some awesome old radio shows to share with you that are pretty creepy and spooky. The first one is from the series Horror Fantasy, and is their version of a story written by Bram Stoker called The Judge's House.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Granite Furniture Company, with stores in Sugar House, Murray, and Provo, presents
The Hall of Fantasy. Welcome to The Hall of Fantasy. Welcome to the series of radio dramas dedicated to the supernatural, the unusual, and the unknown. Come with me, my friends. We shall ascend to the world of the unknown and forbidden, down to the depths where the veil of time is lifted and the supernatural reigns as king. Come with me and listen to the tale of The Judge's House.
The Granite Furniture Company brings you The Hall of Fantasy. Listen now to original tales of the imagination and some of the classics of the supernatural as we take you down the corridors of the Hall of Fantasy to the mysterious realms of the unknown. These are stories of eerie and fantastic thrills brought to you by your friends at the Granite Furniture Stores. And now for tonight's story, a radio adaptation by Bob Olson of Bram Stoker's story entitled The Judge's House. Justice. Peace. How can we be certain of either when hatred burns unchecked, even beyond the grave? I am Malcolm Lane. This is my story. I want to tell it to you while there is still time. I watched them carry the parcels into the judge's house. Mrs. Widom, whom I had engaged as my housekeeper for the next 3 months, was directing the activity. She was an amusing little character. I had to promise that she wouldn't have to stay in the house after it began to get dark. The upholsterer's man was coming up the pathway with a cart and a new bed. Mrs. Widom had insisted on this one new piece of furniture because, as she put it,
a bed that just hasn't been aired for 50 years is not fit for young bodies to lie on.
And she was right, of course. But my head was too full of plans for study to worry about such details as my living quarters. As for the tales about the harsh old judge whose house this had once been, I had only a mild enthusiasm. He must have been quite a character, though, to make an entire village fear him and his house, even 50 years after his death. Mrs. Whittam was positive there was something about the old place, though she nor anyone else quite knew what it was. The consensus of opinion, however, was that they would not take all the money in Drinwater's bank to spend an hour here alone. But Mrs. Whittam startled me with a very rational statement.
The place is full of rats. And rats is bogies, just the same as bogies is rats.
That explanation suited me very well, for as I said once before, my head was full of plans to study. Examinations were coming up soon, and I had paid 3 months' rent in this old house so that I would be assured of peace and quiet while I prepared for them. The only mysteries I'm interested in, Mrs. Widom, are those of harmonical progression and elliptical functions. They're mystery enough for me.
Not that you won't find company here, Mr. Lane. I've already cleaned all of 50 years of dust from everything. Oh, but that wainscot in this room must be hundreds of years old. And you'll find creaky doors aplenty, and loose flats all over, ready to flap in the wind. And bureau drawers that stick and then fall down in the middle of the night.
And don't forget the rats.
No, Mr. Lane. Don't forget the rats.
The workmen were all gone, and but for the busy little figure, the housekeeper, I was alone. It was for this that I had taken the tiresome ride to Benchurch, a remote little town that had all the attractions of a desert. It was drawing close to evening as Mrs. Whittam was unpacking the last hamper, and I could see that she was beginning to cast worried glances about as the shadows began to creep into the corners of this huge dining room I'd chosen for my living quarters. Oh, you may go now, Mrs. Whittem. It's getting dark in here, and I'm sure you're anxious to get home. You've done well with this old room. I shall reward you with complete possession of this house for the last 2 months of my tenancy. 3 or 4 weeks will be all I'll need, and I'd hate to see that rent money go to waste.
Thank you kindly, sir, but I wouldn't stay here
I know, for all the money in Drinkwater's bank. I'm really grateful, for I do want to be alone. And if you were not so opposed to it, I might be tempted to accept your company.
Ah, you young gentleman. You fear nothing, and I'm certain you'll get all the solitude you need here. Good night, sir. You'll find your supper beneath the cloth.
Good night, Mrs. Whittem. Oh, yes, this was comfort. After I'd finished my supper, I cleared the great oak table and got my books out. Then when I'd put fresh wood in the fire and trimmed the lamp, I sat down to a spell of hard work. I hardly looked up from my books until nearly 11 o'clock, at which time I threw some more wood in the fire and indulged in one of my most deeply ingrained habits, that of tea drinking. I thoroughly enjoyed tea and drank it this night with a sense of real enjoyment. Soon the new wood I had thrown on the fire began to crackle, and the new flame threw quaint shadows about the great old room. And as I sat there sipping my tea, I reveled in the complete sense of isolation. Then, for the first time, I noticed the noise of the rats. Strange, I hadn't heard them before. Maybe they're just getting used to me. But they're bold enough now. How busy they were. What strange noises they made. Up and down the old wainscot they went, and over the ceiling and over the floor, racing and gnawing and scratching. There were so many of them that I'd have sworn that if they set their strength to it, they could have carried the house away. I had a smile when I recalled the words of Mrs. Whittem. Rats is bogies, and bogies is rats. The stimulation of the tea gave me a sense of security, and I grabbed the lamp to take a good look around the room. Strange why such a beautiful old place should have been so neglected for all this time. The carving on the oak panels of the wainscot was fine indeed, and that around the doors and windows was of rare merit. I saw some old pictures on the wall next to the fireplace, but they were coated so thick with dust that I couldn't distinguish any of their details, even though I did hold the lamp high above my head. Now and then I would get a quick start as the light fell upon the old walls and disclosed the glittering eyes of a rat as he would stick his face out of a hole or a crack. In an instant, it would disappear with a squeak and a scamper. Another object that struck me as odd was the rope of a great alarm bell that hung in the corner of the room on the right-hand side of the fireplace. After my inspection tour, I sat in a high-backed chair that was near the fireplace and sipped from another cup of tea. For a while, I thought the noise of the rats would drive me to distraction, but that eased off and I became accustomed to it, the same as a person gets used to the roar of water when he camps beside a stream. Soon I was so engrossed in a mathematical problem that I forgot everything else in the world. But since the solution to the problem came stubbornly, I looked up and was surprised to see that the fire had fallen to a dull red glow. There was a sudden quiet, the strange hush that comes in the hour before dawn. I became aware for the first time the noise of the rats had ceased. When it had happened, I couldn't remember. But something instinctive told me that it had been in the last few moments and that it had been sudden. I looked up, and what I saw... What I saw was a most amazing thing. For there on the high back chair sat an enormous rat staring at me through deadly, malignant eyes. I tried to frighten it away, but it didn't stir. I made a motion as if to throw something at it. But it only bared its teeth angrily, and its cruel eyes shone all the more bright. I'd grabbed the poker from the hearth and was going to kill the creature. But before I could reach it, that enormous rat jumped to the floor. And with a squeak that sounded like a consummate hit of the whole world, scampered up the rope of the alarm bell and disappeared in the darkness. Then, as if by a signal, the noise of the other rat started all over again. By this time, I gave up working my problem and bartered it for some much-needed sleep. It was Mrs. Whittem who woke me as she came in to make up the room.
You're much paler this morning, Mr. Lane.
I am.
You shouldn't stay up so late with your work. It isn't good for you. But tell me, how did you spend the night? I was certainly glad to see you.
Alive? Oh, yes, that was quite all right, Mrs. Whittem. The something didn't worry me too much. But the rats certainly held themselves at camp meeting. There was one that sat up in that chair by the fireplace and wouldn't go away until I chased him with a poker. It was the biggest old devil I've ever seen.
Old devil? Maybe it was the old devil.
I only meant
Never
that...
you mind, sir. Many a true word is spoken in jest.
Well, pardon me, Mrs. Whittem. I didn't mean to be rude. But the thought of the old devil himself sitting in that chair last night struck me as being rather funny.
And it's a good thing you can laugh. But all the same, if I were to spend the night here tonight, oh, heaven forbid, I'd make sure I was ready for him.
That night, the rats put on an earlier show, for their scamperings began almost as soon as I'd finished with my supper. The cursed creatures seemed to get on my nerves, and I sat there and popped in my pipe. While they squealed and scratched and gnawed, they seemed to grow bolder by the minute. By now they were coming to the chinks and cracks in the wall until their eyes shone like miniature lamps when the firelight struck them. They'd even make bold sallies under the floor, and I'd have to frighten them away by pounding on the table with my fist. That was how I passed the early part of that night. Despite it, I became more and more engrossed in my studies. And then a strange sensation coursed through me. For there it was again. Instinctively, I grabbed the handiest object I could find, a book, and flung it at the baleful little beast. But the book was too hastily aimed, and the huge rat didn't stir. So once again, I went into the poker routine. And once again, it put up the rope of the alarm bell. I tried to follow its flight more closely this time, but before I could see where it went, it had been swallowed up in the shadows. And just as it happened last night, as soon as the big rat had gone, the others resumed their activity. I looked at my watch and found that it was very close to midnight. I built up the fire and brewed myself a pot of tea. I tried to get back to my work, but I suddenly became curious to know where the rat had disappeared to. For I was certain that tomorrow I would most likely get myself a rat trap. I gathered all my books about me and put them in a handy position for throwing. Then I took the rope of the alarm bell and placed the end of it upon the table underneath the lamp, where there would be plenty of light on it. As I picked up the rope, I was amazed how pliable and strong it was. Ideal, I thought, for hanging a man. Soon my preparations were complete. Now this time, my friend, I intend to learn more about you. Once again, I was hard at my work and the noise of the rats was forgotten. But just as suddenly as before, I was aroused by that same sense of startling silence. I was conscious of a slight movement in the rope at my elbow. Without stirring, I checked to see if my pile of books was in easy reach. It was. I cast my glance at the rope just in time to see the huge rat drop from it to the back of a high oak chair. I grabbed a book and hurled it. With amazing agility, the rat sprang aside and dodged it. I threw a second and a third, but each time it managed to dodge my battery. It was almost funny, almost. Finally, when I was down to the last book, I took careful aim, and as I did this, the rat squeaked and seemed afraid. I let the book fly. It struck the rat with a resounding thud. It gave out a shrill, terrified shriek, and running up the back of the chair, made a desperate leap, and with the speed of a bolt of lightning, ran up the bell rope. The lamp rocked with a strain, but it didn't topple. Then I saw the rat leap to a molding and disappear through the hole in one of the big pictures that hung on the wall. I made a mental note of the exact spot. Third picture from the fireplace, huh? I'll remember that and have Mrs. Whittem scrub it clean the first thing tomorrow morning. I began to pick up the books I had thrown at the rat. As I did so, I took a good look at their titles. Conic Sections. Mr. Rat doesn't seem to mind that. It would be this one on cycloidal oscillations. And this one on thermodynamics he dodged very neatly. Oh. Here's the book that got him. As I looked at the title of the book that had finally hit the huge rat, I could feel a pallor spread across my face. For the title of that book was The Holy Bible.
You are listening to The Judge's House by Bram Stoker in tonight's journey down the corridors of the Hall of Fantasy,
brought to you by your friends at the Granite Furniture Company, with stores in Sugar House, Murray, and Provo. And now back to the story by Bram Stoker, entitled The Judge's House.
Mr. Lane, this is Dr. Thornhill.
Dr. Thornhill, are you ill, Mrs. Whittem?
Your pardon, Mr. Lane, but Mrs. Whittem wanted me to come up here and have a talk with you.
A talk? Well, in that case, let me prepare some tea for you.
Oh, please don't. That's one of the things I came to talk to you about. Mrs. Whittem thinks you drink more strong tea than is good for you. She tells me also that you put in quite long hours at your studies.
Mrs. Whittem, I engaged you as a housekeeper, not as a guardian.
Oh, please, Mr. Lane, I didn't
mean to. As a matter of fact, Lane, she didn't mean to have me talk to you at all. That was my idea.
I see. Well, now that you're here, what do you want me to do?
Leave this house.
Well, even if I could see the reason for it, I doubt if I would. But as for the tea and late hours, I might be able to give them up. Would it make you feel any better, Mrs. Whittem, if I promised not to study after 1 o'clock tonight?
Yes, if you promise.
Then I promise.
I advise you, not as a total stranger to your problem, Mr. Lane. I was a student once myself, you know.
Of course. Shall we shake on a doctor?
Fine. Now, if you will, I wish you'd tell me what you've noticed in this house.
Well, it's just as I've told Mrs. Whittem. I'd be working late, and I'd suddenly be... And when I looked to see which book it was that had struck the rat, the devil, as Mrs. Whittem calls it, I was amazed to find that it was the Holy Bible. There now. Please, Mrs. Whittem, you're not hurt.
Now, Mr. Lane, you say the rat always went up the rope of that alarm bell?
Always.
I suppose you know what that rope is?
No, why?
It's the very rope the hangman used to execute the victims of the judge's hatred.
Oh, no.
Now, Mrs. Whittem, there's no reason to get upset about this, really.
Doctor, you shouldn't put such horrible thoughts in poor Mr. Lane's mind. He has enough to unseat him already.
I did it for a definite purpose. Mr. Lane, I want you to fix your attention on that rope. Now, I know you're sound of mind and body, but hard work and long hours and this suggestion of the devil, especially in this lonely old house, can do things to the mind. Now, I don't mean this as any offense, but if you should find yourself having, well, hallucinations or some unexplainable fright, I want you to pull that rope. It'll give us some kind of a warning in the village. We might be able to be of some help.
Well, thank you, Doctor. I'll do that. I may get stuck with a problem.
Fine. Goodbye, Mr. Lane, and, well, I wouldn't be surprised if Benchurch hears the alarm bell from the judge's house tonight.
I didn't quite share the doctor's views, but just the same, I caught myself staring at the bell rope. The more I stared, the more restless I became, and every now and then my mind would conjure up the vision of some wretched victim dangling from the end of it. But that line of thinking would have me out of my mind in a hurry. Mrs. Whittem had made the place neat and homey. I wandered over to one of the big windows and flung it open. I was surprised to find that a sharp wind had come up, a very cold wind for April. It was more than a sharp wind, really, for it was carrying a storm. Little drops of rain began to pelt me in the face until soon it came a thing of fury. I bolted the shutters and built up the fire with some fresh wood. I was uncomfortable and was only vaguely conscious of the reason. Suddenly I knew. The rats were quiet tonight. It gave me a slight case of the jitters, and I instinctively took a hasty glance at the bell rope. The rope was quite still. I wanted a hot cup of tea, but remembering my promise to Mrs. Whittem, I desisted. Instead, I sat at the great oak table and opened my books. Soon I had started a problem, and the noise of the rats began. For the first time since I had taken up residence in the judge's house, I was glad to hear those rats. I had worked for an hour or so and suddenly became conscious of the furious storm outside. I was thankful that I didn't have to be out of it. The late movement of the bell rope compelled me to walk over to it and take it in my hand. I saw nothing. It had only been the wind, and the rope was rising and falling gently with each new gust of air, which caused the bell to sway back and forth a little. That rope had a deadly fascination to it. I wondered why the judge wanted such a grisly memento in his house. The thought of it sent a chill through me. Or was it a thought? Didn't I sense a tremor along that rope? I couldn't be sure, but at that moment I remembered the picture. I walked over to the table, picked up the lamp, and approached the spot where I'd seen the picture the night before. I counted out the pictures until I came to the third one from the fireplace. Even before I raised the lamp, I could see that Mrs. Whittem had washed it clean as I had told her to do. Then what I saw... what I saw gave me such a start that I nearly dropped the lamp. My knees almost gave way beneath me, and I was conscious of huge beads of perspiration that were forming on my forehead. Just looking at it made me tremble like an aspen leaf. The picture seemed fairly to leap out at me. For there, dressed in his scarlet and ermine robes with a judge, with his merciless, evil face, his sensual mouth, and a nose that was shaped like the beak of a bird of prey. His face had a cadaverous culling. It was a ghastly picture. But it was the eyes that really made me go cold. For those eyes were... and heaven help me if I'm going mad. Those eyes were the exact duplicate of the evil eyes of the great rat. The picture had been painted in this very room. I began to compare the two, and as my eyes swept the room, they were suddenly riveted to the judge's chair. For there, with a rope hanging behind it, sat the huge rat with the judge's eyes, and the hatefulness was now intensified with a fiendish leer. Never did the wind howl so. This had to stop. I wanted some tea, but I didn't take any. The doctor had been quite right. The nerve must have been getting drawn pretty taut. Strange, too, because I never was in better health. Well, no tea. We'll substitute some brandy. Let's see him in there. I had a stiff glass of the brandy and went back to work. The rats were at it again, and I was glad to hear them, for they had become a sort of symbol of normalcy. The storm raised such a fury that I was unaware of anything else. But once, during a sharp, silent lull, I heard another sound, a faint squeaking noise. I listened for it again and soon detected it. It was coming from the corner of the room where the bell rope hung. At first, I thought it was just the motion of the rope in the storm, but I looked up and saw something in the dim light that made me all the more positive that I was going mad. For there was the great rat, clinging to the rope and gnawing at it. I could see the lighter coloring where the bare strands were exposed. Just then, the rat finished its job, and the rope fell to the floor with a thud. For a moment, the huge rat just hung there like a tassel. It was then that I realized what had happened. My only contact with the village was now gone. I don't know why, but I rushed to the lamp on the table, snatched off the shade, and ran over to the picture of the judge. A chill of horror went through me. But I think I must have expected what I saw. It seemed more like a confirmation than a shock. For there in the center of the picture was a great patch of brown canvas, as clean and as fresh as the day it had been drawn over the frame. And where the portrait of the judge himself had been, there was nothing. I heard a sound behind me. When I turned around, I really got the palsy. I suddenly became incapable of movement. I could hardly think. I had been prepared to see most anything, but what was there? For there in the judge's high-backed chair, with his black cap in his hand, his ermine robes fixed about him with a smile of triumph, twisting his cruel mouth, was the judge himself. As the clock struck the hour, it seemed to beat the blood right out of my heart. At the 12th stroke, the judge placed the black cap on his head and walked deliberately over to the place where the piece of bell rope lay in a heap on the floor. He picked it up and drew it through his hands as one would a valuable fur pelt. Then he began to knot one end, fashioning it into a noose. He tightened it and tested it with his foot. All this time, he never took his horribly cruel eyes from my face. I began to feel trapped. For some reason, I could barely move. I could only watch as he started to move along the table toward me. Then, with a quick movement, he threw the noose at me, as if to ensnare me in it. It missed. He raised it again, never once taking those hateful eyes from my face. Once more, the noose came, flying toward me. Once more, with some last ounce of strength, I dodged it. The room seemed flooded with light. The lamp had suddenly flared up high. I looked about the room and was astonished to see the shiny little eyes of the rats as they peered out the cracks and chinks in the wall. I looked up at the bell rope, my lost and last hope of warning the village. It was covered with the little fellows. Funny thing, but those rats were the only thing that gave me even the slightest sense of comfort. For as the rats clambered along the bell rope, the bell itself began to sway, and I heard a tiny sound, yes, very tiny, as the clapper touched the bell itself. It was only a whisper of a sound, but it would grow louder in time. Or would it? At this sound, the judge looked up, and a scowl of terrible anger came to his face. His eyes were like red-hot coals, and he stamped his foot so that the house seemed to shake. The rats kept running up and down the rope as if they were conscious that it was a race against time. Now the judge was approaching me with a noose in his hand. As he came closer, there seemed to be something paralyzing in his presence, and I stood as rigid as a corpse. Suddenly, I felt the judge's icy fingers against the skin of my throat. He was adjusting the rope above my neck. Then he picked me up and stood me on the high oak chair and put his hand on the swaying end of the bell rope. As he raised his hand, I was conscious of my little rat friends fleeing through the hole in the ceiling. They were my last hope. I stood there on the chair and couldn't move a muscle. Now that my last hope seemed gone, I wanted the judge to hurry and get it over with. Soon he'd tied the end of the rope just above my neck, the dangling end of the bell rope. Then he jumped down to the floor and looked at me with those eyes that hated me so. The smile of diabolical triumph seemed to wreathe him in horror. I began to wonder about hangings. I wondered how long it would take, whether the doctor in the village could possibly reach me in time. For I knew that I would soon be sounding the alarm bell. I even wondered what kind of a shadow I'd cast on the wall as I dangled from the end of the rope in this grotesque candlelight. But I didn't wonder for long, because suddenly the judge grabbed the chair on which I was standing with a sudden movement, jerked it out from under me.
So runs the tale of The Judge's House. Remember to join us next week at the same time for another journey down the corridors of the Hall of Fantasy.
Tonight's program was adapted from the story by Bram Stoker entitled The Judge's House. Heard in tonight's program were Dick Thorne as Malcolm Lane, Beth Calder as Mrs. Woodham, and Mal Wyman as the Doctor. Musical background was provided by Earl Donaldson. The technical supervisor was Nephi Sorensen. This program was written by Bob Olson and produced and directed by Richard Thorne. Remember, be with us again next Sunday night on call at 8:30 p.m. when the Granite Furniture Stores in Sugar House, Murray, and Provo will take you on another journey down the corridors of the Hall of Fantasy.
Okay, can I just say that is the creepiest rat ever? The great big one that sits in the high back chair? Even creepier than those guys in the banana boat, if you know what I mean. Anyway, the next program I have for you comes from the series called Suspense, and is their production of the H.P. Lovecraft story, The Dunwich Horror, starring Ronald Coleman.
Produced, edited, and directed by William Spear. Come in, Dunwich, Massachusetts. Come in, Dunwich.
Good evening. This is Henry Armitage. I'm speaking to you. Dr. Rice, please close the window, will you? I'm speaking to you from my laboratory on the slopes of Sentinel Hill near Dunwich, Massachusetts. Present with me is Dr. Warren Rice, my distinguished colleague from Miskatonic University. We are now about 100 yards from the summit of the hill, which is crowned by a huge table-like stone set in the center of a circle of stone pillars, a place of prehistoric worship. A moment ago, you may have heard the dogs of Dunwich Township barking as we have heard them for 3 days and 3 nights. Dr. Rice and I know the horror which their barking portends, but the purpose of this broadcast is to make this unbelievable horror believable to you. I hope for your sakes and ours we are successful tonight. It is the eve of All Hallows. Tomorrow will be too late. Our time tonight is very short, so I'll speak only of those more recent events which, believe me, may culminate at any moment in a climax too frightful to wholly contemplate. I will begin with the birth of Wilbur Whately. It was the night of February the 2nd, 1921. Candlemas. Toward dawn, when Lavinia Whately, a deformed albino woman about 35 years old, gave birth to her dark, goatish-looking son in the crumbling Whately farmhouse northeast of the village. No one attended her. No doctor or midwife. No one was with her, except her aged, half-insane father, who was known as Wizard Whately. So Wilbur came into this world under heaven knows what incantations, what appeals to what power. A week later, Wizard Whately drove his sleigh into Dunwich Village and reported the event to a group of loungers in Osborne's general store.
Hey, your grandson got yellow hair like Lavinia Wizard?
No, takes after his father more. He's dark, dark.
You never spoke of who his father might be now, did you?
Oh, you know his father when the time comes. Oh, Lavinia's read and seen some things the most of you only talk about. Calculate her husband's as good as you can find this side of Aylesbury.
Well, we don't be nosy, Wizard.
Maybe it weren't in no church that none of you heard of. But you wouldn't ask no better church wedding than Lavinia's.
Well, I didn't hear tell of no wedding, Wizard. When was that?
Oh, not a wedding you'd hear of, Corey. Not a husband you'd hear of, neither. But let me tell you something. Someday you folks will hear a child of Lavinia's calling its father's name on top of Sentinel Hill.
Prophecy? Or idle boasting by an insane old man? Oh, I know I ask a great deal when I ask you to believe that the arrival of an infant into that house of dire poverty and squalor could possibly constitute a horror and a threat to all our known world. Yet it has an earthly history. Perhaps through this history, you will be able to give it credence. Wilbur Whately's growth was uncanny. But even if he had been an average child, he would have become, in time, an unnatural being, for he was surrounded from the first by the most malign influences. There was his grandfather, old Whately, Wizard Whately, who each Halloween climbed Sentinel Hill to the great circle of stone, and while the hills shook, stood holding a great book open on his arms and shrieked into the wind. Shrieked.
Jump! Jump off! Jump! Jump off!
Yog-Sothoth, that dreadful name, first mentioned in the hideous forbidden book, the Necronomicon. And this Wizard Whately was Wilbur's teacher. The villagers began to notice curious things that were going on at the Whately farmhouse. Soon after Wilbur was born, old Whately began to remodel the house. The abandoned upper story was restored, and all the windows were tightly boarded up. And then, Wizard began to buy cattle in large numbers, both horses and cows. Yet the livestock on the farm didn't seem to increase. Young Lem Brown was one day curious enough to creep close to the house to count the Whately herd.
Dr. Armitage, there weren't more than 12 cows, and them sick. Looked like they had the blight and funny wounds on them, like cuts. I heard something, too, in the top part of Wizard's house. Something like water slapping inside, only big, big like a sea.
One other person went to the Whateley farm in the years before I met Wilbur, Dr. Ken Houghton of Aylesbury, who was called by Wilbur himself, who said that his grandfather was dying. Dr. Houghton found the old man in a bedroom on the ground floor, and Wilbur with him. While outside the window, a legion of whippoorwills cried loudly and rhythmically, endlessly. Wilbur spoke about the sound.
Whistling time with his breathing now. They're ready. Listen, doctor. They know his soul's going out. They're waiting.
Yes, Wilbur, that's an interesting superstition. Late in the year for them, too.
And when he goes, if they catch him, they'll keep laughing till break of day. If they don't catch him, they'll quiet down.
You mean you believe that... In just a minute. I think he's conscious.
Yes, the birds changed when his breathing changed. Like
Willie,
I say...
Willie!
I'm here.
More space, Willie. Remember, more space soon.
Yes, I'll build it.
You grows... But that grows faster. It'll be ready to serve you soon, Willie.
I know.
But remember, when it's time, you open up the gates to Yog-Sothoth with a long chant. The one on page 751 of the book. But mind you, feed it enough. Because if it gets out before you opens to Yog-Sothoth, it's all over. It's no use.
He's going now. He's dead, Wilbur.
Listen. The birds. They didn't get him. Yes, he's free. He's gone.
It was the winter following Wizard Whateley's death that I first met Wilbur. He came in person to the library at Miskatonic University to consult a copy of the hideous Necronomicon, which was kept there in its Latin version, as printed in Spain in the 17th century. I tell you, when he came into my office, I was appalled at his appearance. 8 feet tall, shabby, dirty, bearded. But I was even more appalled by his voice when he spoke to me.
I wrote you a letter a month past, Doctor. I wanted a loan of the book.
Well, that's a book that's never loaned from this library. I doubt if it is from any library.
Well, I have to see it, then.
Oh, very well, it's kept right here. As you know, there are only 3 copies of this book in existence. That's why we're careful. Here, you can look at it on this table.
Wizard said it would be on page 751.
What? What is it you're looking for?
The formula... The long chant. The one that opens the gate to Yog-Sothoth.
I felt a wave of fright as tangible as a draft from the tomb. It seemed somehow like the spawn of another dimension. Like something only partly of mankind. Linked to black gulfs beyond all spheres of force and matter, space and time. And presently he raised his head and spoke again.
It's here, all right. But I'll have to have a copy.
That paragraph there? I don't know.
Do you know Latin, Doctor?
Yes, certainly.
Then read it, Doctor. Let let's hear how you make it out.
All right, that shouldn't be difficult. Let's see. Nor is it to be thought that man is the oldest or the last of Earth's masters. The old ones were, and the old ones shall be. Not in the spaces that we know, but between them. But only Yog-Sothoth knows the gate. Yog-Sothoth is the gate to where the old ones broke through of old. Their hands are at your throats, yet ye see them not.
Dr. Armitage, you see, I reckon I've got to take that book home. There's things in it I've got to try, and you can't hold me up.
No, I'm sorry.
I tell you, Doctor, I'll have the book sooner or later, no matter what. You see, it that's waiting for me at home won't wait much longer.
It was a week later that I was awakened suddenly by the fierce yelping of the great watchdog on the campus, followed by a sound from a wholly different throat, a scream. And I knew instantly that Wilbur had come back for the Necronomicon. I hastened into my clothes and rushed across to the library where a crowd had gathered before the smashed window of my office. Inside, there was a fearful groaning and growling, and some instinct warned me that what was taking place there was not for unfortified eyes to see. I brushed back the crowd, motioning only to Professor Rice to come in with me. When we opened the study door, Professor Rice screamed.
No, Dr. Armitage, no, I can't.
Come, close the door. We can't let them see. He's alive, but Lord, what a job that dog's done. Torn him to bits. That's a horrible sound, that moaning. You suppose we ought to call a doctor?
A doctor? A doctor for that? No doctor in the world would know what to do for that. Look, Armitage, it's not human, nor animal. Where did it come from? Can you tell me? Can you tell me what it is?
No, I couldn't tell what Wilbur Whately was. A thing that lay half bent on its side in a pool of greenish-yellow stickiness was 9 feet tall. The dog had torn off all the clothing and some of the skin. It was partly human, beyond a doubt, with very man-like hands and head, but the torso and lower parts of the body were fabulous. Its chest had the leathery hide of a crocodile or alligator. But below the waistline, the skin was covered with coarse black fur. And from the abdomen, long greenish-gray tentacles. The limbs terminated in ridgy veined pads that were neither hooves nor claws. And as Dr. Rice and I stood staring at this presence, the whippoorwills began to cry in unison outside the study window. And then the thing on the floor roused and mumbled.
Armitage, in heaven's name.
Listen. The whippoorwill. Listen. He's dead now. Look, Rice, look what's happening.
He's disintegrating.
Of course. Fast, too. Fading away. Because he isn't made of matter as we know it on Earth. I guess he took after his father. So there'll be nothing left.
His father? What was his father?
I daren't think. I thought then that what came into our world with Wilbur Whately left with him. I forgot what he himself had told me of it, which was waiting in the sealed house Wizard Whately had built, where the cattle were driven to disappear. But Wilbur Whately left a diary, written in a strange alphabet resembling Sanskrit, and I worked off and on for weeks to decipher it. And finally, I read the following passage written by Wilbur when he was no more than 8 years old.
That upstairs is more ahead of me than I had thought it would be, and is not like to have much earth brain. I can see it a little when I make the sign or blow the powder of Ivangatsi at it, and it is like them I see Halloween on the hill. I wonder how I shall look when the earth is cleared and there are no earth beings. Maybe like that upstairs looks, which has no body, even fed with all the blood.
Toward morning, in a cold sweat of terror, I called Dr. Rice to my house and told him we have to destroy what's in that farmhouse.
Why can't we just leave the thing locked up there? The house is boarded tight.
Yes, but do you think boards will hold it? Don't you realize, man, it hasn't been fed? It hasn't had blood since the 18th of September, when Wilbur Whately came here to die. We left for Dunwich that night, and we've been here on Sentinel Hill ever since, working desperately to discover the formula in time. But a week ago tonight, shortly after dawn... Yeah, hello?
Dr. Armitage, this is Lem Brown. I was just up beyond the glen, Doctor, looking for cows I lost last night.
Yes, Lem?
Well, Doctor, something's been there. Smells like thunder. And there's prints in the road. Great round prints, big as barrel heads, like an elephant has been along.
Anything else, Lem?
That's all I see. Except bushes and trees pushed back from the road like a house was drug along.
Oh. Did you hear anything?
Yes. Long toward morning, I heard a sound over toward Whately's place. A kind of ripping or tearing of wood like a big box was being opened up. Chancy, he heard it too.
Lem, who lives nearest the Whately farm?
Why, that'd be Elmer Fry's place.
Oh, he's on this line too, isn't he? Hang on and I'll ring him.
Yes, Dr. Armitage, this is Central.
I'm trying to get Elmer Fry, Central.
Doctor, he must be out somewheres, and his whole family. I was ringing there an hour ago. Earl Sawyer saw Elmer's cows stampeding in Cold Spring Glen.
Oh, you didn't get him. All right. But if you hear or see anything more, let me know. I'll be here working all day. Rice! Oh, wake up. It's loose. It's out of the house. One family gone already. We have to work. Pray God we find that formula in time. A week since it broke loose. A week of terror and panic here in Dunwich Township. Each night it moves about the countryside, leaving the trees crushed in a 30-foot swathe, as though by a moving mountain, leaving its monstrous tracks and a trail of tarry stickiness, leaving crushed and gutted farmhouses and whole herds of cattle drained of blood. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that is the story to this moment. And tonight is Halloween. Tonight we are here to...
Just one moment, please. Dr. Rice, did you hear something?
With the window closed, no.
Well, we'll throw it open. I thought so. Listen. A sound from a thousand bending trees. A sound like the sea moving across a forest. Yes. Yes, it's coming here, of course. All Hallows, it comes to Sentinel Hill. Dr. Rice, I'll try the formula and the powder from the altar stone. I want you to stay here at the microphone and report what you see.
Very well, Dr. Armitage.
Oh, wait a minute before I go. To any scientists who may be listening to me, if I fail, there is a possible alternative formula in Falconer's Mystical Formulae of the Middle Ages on page 24. Listen. Well, there are the whippoorwills. I better get out there. Take over, Dr. Rice.
Yes. I'll do as well as I can, Armitage. Good luck. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Armitage is climbing to the top of the hill, to the altar stone. I can see him plainly, for the moon is high and the night clear. Down the hill, toward the dark village, I can see the grasses and shrubbery bending down, marking the monster's ascent. It moves quite fast, and I feel a proximity to phases of being utterly forbidden. Now, Dr. Armitage stands now on the altar stone and is holding the powder which, if the books are correct, will make this thing for an instant visible. It is quite close to him now, perhaps 20 yards or less. He lifts his hands, he brings the powder in a wide arc. I can see... Oh, no! No!
Dr. Rice, come in, Dunnage. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your suspense announcer. Due to conditions... Oh, just a moment, please. One moment, please. Dr. Rice, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Yes, for a moment I was overcome when I saw... Ladies and gentlemen, perhaps you can hear now the incantation of Dr. Armitage. Listen. Dr. Armitage is walking back here now. So we know that whatever it was, it is gone. It is dead. We can be thankful indeed. You see, I saw Dr. Armitage.
Yes. Did you? Did you see it, Dr. Rice?
I saw it, Lord, yes.
What did it look like to you?
It looked
here
like something made of squirming ropes, but bigger than a barn and shaped, well, like an egg, and dozens of legs, like barrels, but half closed when it stepped, and nothing solid about it, and at least 15 or 20 mouths or trunks opening and closing, but what was it?
Oh, a kind of force that doesn't belong in our part of space. Did you notice the half face on top?
Half face. Like a human face.
Yes, very large, but yes, quite human. And quite like Wilbur's, like all the weightless.
Then it was...
That's right. It was Wilbur's twin brother. And you saw what 3 weeks' growth had done. And it was the child of Lavinia's who called its father's name on Sentinel Hill, as Wizard Whately prophesied. You heard it calling, Yog-Sothoth. Ladies and gentlemen, this night is over. It is All Saints' Day. May heaven bless us all.
Dunwich Horror, with Ronald Coleman as your star of Suspense. This is the Armed Forces Radio Service.
Whew! That was a freak fest if ever I heard one. Well, I have one more program for you now. From the series Inner Sanctum, it's The Undead.
Lipton Tea and Lipton Soup present Inner Sanctum Mysteries. Good evening, friends of the Inner Sanctum. This is your host to welcome you through the squeaking door for another half hour of lovely chills and shudders. Oh, before we begin tonight, I'd like to give you a word of advice. If you should ever walk through a cemetery at midnight and come face to face with a transparent personality floating above a tombstone, don't be frightened. After all, you can see right through him.
Good gracious, why do we have to talk about cemeteries?
Because, Mary, our story tonight is about a vampire. Where else would you expect to find one if not in a cemetery? In the Vampire State Building?
Well, suppose you go wait in that closet there and talk to the skeleton while I have a word with our Lipton listeners about one secret of success. You know, folks, when a Hollywood actress climbs up to stardom, it's usually because there's something different about her personality. And that's true of other success stories. Lipton Tea, for example, is the largest selling brand of tea in the world because it's different from other teas. Lipton's has that wonderful hearty flavor the tea experts call brisk, which means it's bright and zestful in taste, never wishy-washy or flat. Now, don't take my word for it. Compare Lipton's to other teas yourself. That's the real way to discover Lipton's rich, full flavor, Lipton's extra flavor that brings you all the goodness of a superb tea. It's full-bodied and satisfying, with a smooth, mellow tang that brings you real enjoyment. So pour yourself a cup of Lipton tea, folks, and then see for yourself what a difference that brisk flavor makes.
That's fine, Mary, but quietly, my dear.
Why the whisper, mister?
Shh. Don't make too much noise or you'll wake the dead. And we don't want to do that because tonight's story is called The Undead. It's an original radio play by Milton Lewis. Yes, and our star tonight is Anne Seymour, who plays the role of Diana.
I was alone, here in the penthouse, sleeping. The doors leading to the terrace were open. Suddenly, I was awakened by a queer, whirring noise that sounded like the flapping of wings. I opened my eyes. Moonlight filled the room. It was one of those clear, cloudless nights that the winds moaned and howled like weeping women. Somewhere, a dog howled. I sat up, peered into the green light of the moon. Seeing nothing at first, I lay down again. My eyes were half closed, and I heard it again, the sound of wings beating on the air. I told myself it was nothing, until out of the queer green shadows that surrounded me like a mist, I saw a pair of blood-red eyes close to my face. No! They weren't human eyes. They were rimmed with green. And they glittered like glass in the dark. I looked closer. Too frightened to move. Too terrified to cry out. The thing that seemed to be flying round my head looked like a bat. Said it wasn't a bat. Suddenly it floated down. I felt soft fur on my neck. And my throat was pierced with a sharp, terrible pain. I started screaming, "Let me go! Let me go! Richard!
Where are you,
Richard? Richard!"
Go on, Diana.
When I felt their arms around me, I knew I was safe, Richard, but it, It was the most horrible dream I ever had.
Yes, I know, darling. You were hysterical.
What do you think it meant?
Well, nothing. Nothing, of course, dear. Everyone has nightmares like that sometime or other.
But it was so vivid. I could almost swear it happened just as I told it to you.
Now, Diana, do you really believe you've encountered a vampire?
I know it sounds ridiculous, darling.
Listen, baby, you're living in New York City on top of an 18-story building. This is 1945, not the Middle Ages. Well, the whole notion is just rubbish.
I tried to tell myself it was nonsense, too. But somehow... Oh, Richard, I want to get out of this place.
But why?
I don't like this apartment. There's something evil, sinister here. I've always felt it. And listen. Listen to that wind. The wind howl around here all the time.
Well, naturally, it's a penthouse, and it catches the winds from the river.
You hear that? Something flapping on the terrace.
That's just the awning.
There are always queer noises around here. All the time, and I can't bear it being alone here at night. Richard, please, please don't let me stay here alone tonight.
I can't stay with you, darling. I've got to go to the
theater. I don't want you to go there, please. Let your understudy take the part tonight. Take me away from here. Far away where it's warm and there's sunlight.
Diana, you don't know what you're saying, dear. I can't give up my part in the show.
Of course. Of course. Oh, darling, forgive me, please. I'm sorry I ever mentioned it. You do forgive me, don't you, Richard? Say you do.
Why, of course. You're just upset over the silly dreams.
I know, I know. I won't mention it again.
You're okay, baby. Well, it's 7:50. I'd better get going. Want to come with me?
Yes. No. Well, I'm going to stay here.
But if this place frightens you...
That's just why I'm going to stay. And alone. I'm going to beat this thing. Somehow.
That's better, darling. Much better.
Here's your coat. Right. And you better take your scarf. It feels chilly. Richard, I said I won't mention it again, but there's one thing more I have to tell you. That the face of that thing in my dream, it was your face.
Diana, in the name of heaven.
I won't talk of it anymore. I promise you, darling. I didn't mean to upset you just before you went to the theater. Just kiss me, dear. I'll be all right. I'll be all right.
Diana.
Good night, dear. I'll be waiting when you get back. It was just midnight, two nights later. I was waiting for Richard to come home from the theater. I was going through his desk looking for a postage stamp, and I found something that turned my blood to ice. It was a newspaper clipping dated 10 years ago. The picture of a man, and under it the caption, "Prominent real estate operator Richard Barker, found dead of a sudden stroke." I looked at the picture again. There could be no doubt of it. It was Richard. I read further. The deceased will be buried at Woodlawn, Greenlawn Cemetery after services in the Westland Funeral Chapel.
Good evening, Diana.
Richard.
Why, what's the matter? You seem startled.
I didn't hear you come in.
Have you been brooding again?
No, Richard. Of course not.
How do you feel tonight?
Not very well.
Weak?
Weak. Sleepy. Ill.
Well, no wonder. You've hardly been eating a thing. And I know that you never catch a wink of sleep.
I told you I can't sleep in the daytime as you do. As you do.
Why are you staring at me like that?
Why? Why do you sleep in the daytime?
I've been doing it for years.
Years?
What's so terrible about that? Most theatrical people do. We live and work at night.
Yes. Yes, I know.
Really, Diana, what is the matter with you?
Nothing. You think I'm losing my mind?
Well, I don't know what to think.
Why are you pretending?
Pretending what?
That you're something other than what you are. Because I know what you are, Richard.
Really?
I found out. This clipping I found in your desk, it tells how you died.
That clipping? Oh, that.
Why are you laughing?
Well, you see, it's a joke. It's a gag. One of my pictures was sent to the papers, publicity for a new play, you know, and a drunken typester put it in the obituary column. It's quite an amusing story.
I don't believe you. You're lying.
Listen, you can't go on like
no,
this.
No, don't touch me.
You're not well, darling.
Get your hands away from me.
But I just want to kiss
no,
you.
No, don't touch me.
Diana, where are you going?
Out of here.
Diana, come back.
I'll come back when I've proved something to myself.
want, ma'am?
I'm sorry to wake you up. Are you the caretaker here at Green Lawn?
Many years, ma'am.
I want to see the grave of Richard Barker.
Who are you?
Diana Barker. His wife.
But it's 1 a.m, Mrs. Barker.
I know what time it is. I want to see the grave.
No one comes at a time like this.
Please, will you tell me? Perhaps this will help.
$10.
For disturbing you.
All right. You take the path in back of my house. Turn to the right. Have you flashed me?
I brought one from the car.
It's only a short way, but it isn't a grave, ma'am. It's sort of a tomb.
Thank you. I'll find it.
You want me to come with you?
No, I've troubled you enough. Good night.
Good night.
Somewhere, an owl was howling, as though warning me not to go on with this insane adventure. But I knew I had to continue. I had to be certain. I followed his directions along the path of the cemetery. The moon poked yellow fingers through scudding clouds as though showing me the way. I was frightened. Terrified. There's nothing to fear from the dead. I kept telling myself that to keep up my courage. The dead. Perhaps they were right. There was nothing to fear from them. But the undead. It was a tomb. The inscription was clear. Here lies Richard Barker, born May 7, 1890, died September 4th, 1935. There was a lock on the door. It was old and rusty. I'd come this far. I made up my mind. I picked up a stone. Smashed the lock. I opened the door. Blackness. Inky blackness, such as one imagines one would see at the end of the world. Turned on the flashlight I took from the car. Coffin was lying in the center of the tomb on an altar. I felt my heart beating wildly, like a throbbing drum inside me. With a trembling hand, I opened the coffin. I looked down on a ghastly white satin lining. That was all there was in the coffin. There was nothing else. It was empty. I looked up. There was a face staring at me in the shadows of the tomb. It was Richard.
Diana, I knew you'd come here.
Well, friend, that just goes to show that an empty coffin makes the most noise. You know, this is the kind of nice domestic story I like. The intimate family chronicle of a vampire.
My goodness, is that what you call intimate family life?
Why, of course, Mary. It looks like our lovebirds will even share the same coffin.
I'm afraid you're drawing a very strange picture of family life, Mr. Holst. Now, I always picture the family gathered around the dinner table. Everybody's laughing and happy. The bright lights push back the shadows of evening outside and shine on the teacups, where Lipton tea is waiting to add to the family's mealtime pleasure. Lipton's brisk flavor will make that good meal taste even better. Everyone around the table, from junior to grandfather, will enjoy its tempting fragrance, its deep amber color, and that brisk flavor that makes Lipton's different from other teas. They'll all like its full-bodied, hearty goodness and the zestful tang of Lipton's flavor. So serve Lipton tea for dinner at your house, folks, and round out the family picture with real enjoyment.
Right, Mary. And now let's go back to our horrors. Let me see. What dire predicament are we in tonight? Oh, yes. Diana has just discovered that her husband was wandering around his tomb. What would you do in a situation like that? Here's what Diana did. Listen.
I ran blindly, stumbling, tearing my clothes. Somehow I managed to reach the car, start the motor. In the car, I knew it wasn't all some dream. People didn't come back from the dead. Did they? Could they? I drove to the city. I wanted to see the lights, people, hear music. I wanted to be sure this was the world I'd always known. I tried to think. I tried to reason. I tried to understand what had happened to me. Because I knew something was happening to me. Something that I dreaded. I was becoming like them. Like Richard. I felt strange craving. Desires that I didn't dare think of.
Excuse me, Mrs. Barker.
Oh.
May I sit with you?
I don't believe I know you.
Perhaps not. Does it make any difference?
No. No, it doesn't. Please sit down.
Thank you.
I'm glad you came over. I'm glad to be able to talk to anyone tonight.
I've been watching you for the last 10 minutes.
Have you?
You look very strange tonight.
How do you know me?
We all know each other.
We?
Yes. You realize you'll be dead soon.
Dead?
At least what they call dead.
You know what's happened?
Oh, yes, of course. I've seen it happening for weeks. Your face became paler and paler. It will not be long now. You will become one of us.
I don't want to.
It's not in your hands.
It isn't true. It can't be true.
It's quite true. Many of us have gone on for hundreds of years. Those who sustain us become like us.
And I...
There is no escape.
No, I don't believe it.
Don't you feel it? Blood. That strange desire.
Yes.
There. You see?
I don't want to.
I once tried to fight it, too. It's no use.
I'm going away. Far away. Where he can't reach me. I'm going now where no one can reach me.
Waiter. Will you help me here? There's been an accident.
Everything is going to be all right, Diana. Just lie here and rest quietly. You're in your own home.
I opened my eyes and saw Claudia, my older sister. Never was so glad to see anyone in all my life. Claudia had always helped me, always advised me. She'd know what to do.
You want something to eat?
No, I'm not hungry.
But the doctor said you'd have to eat.
How did I get here?
You collapsed in the cocktail lounge. They brought you home.
When?
Last night.
It's dark out.
You've been sleeping almost 24 hours.
Where's Richard?
At the theater. Poor boy, he was so worried about you.
Was he?
He sent for me. I've been with you since last night. Diana, what happened?
It's terribly difficult to explain. I sometimes think I'm losing my mind. I'd be sure that's what it is if I hadn't found out differently.
Tell me about it.
I found out Richard is dead. He's been dead for 10 years.
What are you talking about?
Sue, Claudia. I went to Green Lawn. I saw his tomb. I opened it and the coffin was empty.
Diana.
I know what you're thinking, but I'm not insane. He never sleeps at night. Now I feel this strange craving. Claudia, don't scare me.
You know what you're saying.
Yes, I know it sounds wild, fantastic, but I haven't told this to anyone, but it's true. There are things in this world you only think are primitive superstitions, but Claudia, you must believe me.
Yes, of course, I believe you, dear.
We must destroy Richard. I read about those things. We must destroy him by driving a wooden stake through his heart. That's the only way I can escape from him. That's the only way I can become a human being.
Diana.
You'll help me, Claudia.
Of course, dear. Haven't I always helped you?
Where are you going?
Just to fix you something to eat.
No. No, you're going to leave me. Leave me here alone with him. I won't let you do that, Claudia.
That gun. Where did you get that gun?
We've always had one here. Ever since I first told Richard I was afraid of this place. You're not going to leave me alone now, Claudia. I'm not going to let you.
Of course not.
Get away from that door.
If that's what you want.
Claudia, you come back. No. No, you're insane.
Gone. Insane.
She was so sure I was insane, she didn't even give me a chance to explain. I was alone in the house. I felt terribly weak. I wanted to sleep. I wanted to sleep forever and ever. But I knew if I lay down and closed my eyes, I might never open them again. Never open them and see the world as you or I used to. I'd be something else. I looked at the clock. Almost midnight. Richard would be coming back any minute. I ran to the door, locked it from the inside with a safety bolt. What to do? What to do? Please, I ran to the telephone.
Operator?
Hello, operator. Get me the police and hurry, please.
One moment, please.
Hurry, will you? This is a matter of life and death. Hello, are you ringing them?
Police department. Sergeant Kilway talking.
Hello, police. You've got to help me.
Yes, what is it, please?
My husband, he's going to do something to me tonight. He's going to make me what he is.
What's that, lady?
He's been dead for 10 years. I saw his empty coffin. That's proof, isn't it? That's evidence. You always want evidence, and there it is. Now, do you understand?
Well, I'm not sure I do, lady. What's your name?
Diana Barker.
But all right. Now, calm down. Tell me where you live.
I live... Oh, you think I'm insane, too, don't you?
I didn't say that.
You think I'm crazy, just as Claudia does.
If you'll just give me the address, lady.
Oh, what's the use?
Please, lady.
No one believes it. I know I'm not insane. I knew it, and yet... What's that? His key in the lock. He can't open it. It's bolted from the inside. He's trying to get in. But he can't. Not with that bolt. I won't open it. I won't. I'll just pretend I don't hear it. I'll cover my ears with my hands, and I won't hear it. He can't get in here. If I can keep him out until daylight, I'll be safe. Safe. Suddenly, the doorbell stopped. I knew he hadn't gone away. I could feel him near me. But he couldn't get in. No, he couldn't get into the penthouse. There was no way to get in unless he came through the terrace. And there was no way to get on the terrace unless he could fly. Fly. The wind was screaming. When I turned to look at the French doors leading to the terrace, it was impossible. He couldn't. And yet, he couldn't. And yet, suddenly, the doors burst open. The wind blew through the house like a cyclone. The airframe and the double doors. Richard!
Why didn't you let me in?
How did you get out of the tent?
Never mind. What are you doing with that gun?
Don't come near me, Richard.
Diana?
Go away. Go away and leave me alone.
Give me that gun.
No.
I'm warning you, Diana. You'd better give it to me.
If you take another step toward me, I'll fire.
Diana? You see?
The bullets. They didn't harm you.
No.
But I didn't miss.
No.
It's empty.
You see? It didn't do any good.
What are you going to do?
I'm going to put an end to this once and for all, Diana.
An end?
And I've prepared for this. I have a knife, you see.
Richard.
Don't be afraid, Diana. You won't quite die.
No, no, don't.
Come here, Diana.
No, Richard, no.
You're
no.
Making too much trouble while you're alive.
Help me, someone. Let go of me. I saw the knife over my throat. I beat at his chest with the empty pistol. Then, just before everything became black, I saw three flashes of lightning.
Go on, Mrs. Barker.
When I woke up in the hospital, Inspector, I couldn't believe that I was still alive. It seemed like a miracle.
You would have been dead if it wasn't for your sister.
Claudia.
She came back with one of our men. He shot and killed your husband just as he was about to plunge the dagger into you.
But how did he get in?
He came over the adjoining terrace from the penthouse next door, just as your husband did. No, Mrs. Barker, your husband didn't fly.
But the other things, the picture, the tomb, the empty coffin.
All props for an elaborate scheme your husband worked out to murder you. Richard Barker is not an uncommon name. He found a man with that name who died 10 years ago. He removed the body. Got the whole idea from the dream you told him.
But why?
To establish that you were insane.
Oh.
He planned to murder you and claim he did it in self-defense to protect himself against an insane woman.
But the gun...
Filled with blanks. He wanted to get your money, Mrs. Barker.
But the way I felt, those strange cravings...
You're suffering from anemia. The doctor told us that. It's not uncommon for anemia sufferers to feel the way you did.
I still can't believe it. I still feel that he isn't quite dead.
I'll relieve that fear right now. His body's in the other room. I think you should see it. Come this way, Mrs. Bach. There. Raise the lid of the coffin, Charlie.
Yes, Inspector.
What's the matter?
He looks so lifelike. His lips are so reddish. He looks as though he could move. Get up at any minute.
Nonsense. I assure you he's quite dead, Mrs. Barker. And I can further assure you that the police department has never encountered one authentic vampire in its history.
You're very reassuring, Inspector. I think I'd better leave now. Don't bother to see me to the door.
All right, Charlie. Cover him up and have him buried.
Okay, Inspector.
What is it, Charlie?
Inspector. Maybe I'm nuts, but I could swear that I saw him move.
Oh, nonsense. Close the lid. It's getting dark, Charlie. Sun sure goes down quick these winter days. I'm going home. Good night, Charlie.
Well, friend, do you think Richard is really dead? That's something for you to sleep on when you go to bed tonight. Oh, and by the way, we have a moral for tonight's story. Yes, it's taken from a diary of Miss Delirium Tremens, who once said, "Never marry a vampire. He may turn out to be 500 years old without a social security number to his name. How can a girl have any fun going around with a guy like that?"
Well, Mr. Host, I don't think that's a serious problem. I'm positive that no girl will ever meet a vampire, much less marry one.
Ah, but you can't be sure, Mary. The safest thing is to drive a wooden stake through your husband's heart. Yes, if he dies, then he must be a vampire.
Oh, such foolishness.
Oh, by the way, this month's Inner Sanctum mystery novel is The Fearful Passage by H.C. Branson. Until next Tuesday, then. Good night. Pleasant dreams?
Guys, it has been a blast showing these shows with you. Hopefully they didn't creep you out too much and you'll be able to sleep all right. Well, that'll be Pop calling me to dinner. Goodbye, everyone.